Rachel.
Rachel, okay.
I mean, I'm okay without it. I've done it
okay
without it.
Okay.
Actually, I did one too. I was at the IOS where the whole thing is.
Yeah.
Master Shane is like, good.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started if we can. I have a student here who would like to make a brief announcement, Rachel, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Rachel.
Good morning, everybody. Before I start, coming around with a sign-in sheet and also some brochures, please feel free to take one of these. On the sign-in sheet, please make sure you fill in your name and your email. It doesn't affect you in any way. You're not going to see your name box, but it does affect me unless I'm off and I'm here doing my job and that sheet filled out. They don't know that. I can't get paid, so I do appreciate it if you're taking it on. So in front of down here. Yes, I thank all of you for giving me your time. I'm here to talk about Teach for America and its mission to end educational inequity. As many of you have probably seen on the posters around campus, by the time they reach third, fourth grade, students growing up in low-income communities are already 3 to 4 grade levels behind their peers. Now, if you stop to think for a minute what that means, realize that there are fourth graders sitting in classrooms struggling to read Dr. Seuss and Sesame Street when they should be able to read Harry Potter. Or that there are third graders struggling with basic initiative subtraction when they should be mastering lots of inches. And that's what brings me here today. At Teach for America, we believe that closing this achievement gap and ending educational inequity must be our generation's civil rights issue. Students growing up in low-income communities are 7 times less likely than their peers growing up in higher-income communities to graduate from college. That's 7 times less likely to join you, our nation's most outstanding students and most promising future leaders, in the ranks of collegiate alumni. We're looking for those among you from all different academic backgrounds and career aspirations to commit 2 years to teaching in our nation's low-income rural and urban schools. In the short term, we join 3,500 core members who are working relentlessly every single day to improve academic achievement. In the long term, you join a network of over 10,000 alumni. Teach for America has been in existence for 15 years. 10,000 alumni working from every single sector: business, policy, law, education, medicine, you name it, to affect the broader changes that are necessary to ensure that all of our children receive an equal opportunity in life. If you are interested or would like to learn more, we have an information session tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in Meyer Lounge in RNC. I'd also like to encourage those of you who are seniors who may be interested in the program or who are thinking about applying to check out our website. It's www.teachforamerica.org. You can apply online. Our application deadline is February 17th. Those of you who are looking into your future, you can also read more about the program, our relationships with businesses and graduate schools, med schools, law schools, and find out all of the wonderful things that Teach for America has done and read about some of our core members' stories. You can also contact me. I'm in this class, and I'm here at Weiss. My name is Rachel, again, and it's Rachel, L-R-E-C-H-E-L-L, at rice.edu. And again, thank you for your time. And please pass that sheet around. I'll be in the back. I'd really appreciate it if you fill it out. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay, I have a couple of announcements before we get started. The first is that I forgot to tell you on Thursday, I'm so sorry, I forgot to remind you that our first exam is this Thursday. It will cover the material of Units 1 and 2. Typically, on my exams, I'll have 10 questions. They're usually the short answer, multi-part kinds of questions. There are a number of practice exams that you can take a look at that are posted on the website, and I would strongly suggest that you do that. Let me just quickly go there and show you. Hopefully we have internet today. Okay, the practice exams are here. So you can take a look. There are three different practice exam ones that are posted there. And the format of the exam that I'll give on Thursday will be very similar. You'll have the full class time. You may bring a calculator. I would suggest that you do. There will probably be a problem on calculating something like incidence or prevalence or mortality rate. Any questions about the exam before we get started? Everything through today will be covered on the exam. Mm-hmm. Do you have a question? Okay. Any other questions? Okay. You will get 2 bonus points if you wear a class t-shirt. And if you don't get a t-shirt in class today, if you come to my office hours, you can get one there. Okay. There we go. So for homework number 5, you took a look at the Pew Global Attitudes Survey. And I wanted to show some of the results from that homework because I think they're very interesting to think about. We did a survey last time I taught this class at UT in our own class where we asked some of the same questions that were asked on the Pew survey. So we asked the people in our class what fraction were satisfied with their own life. And you can see for UT students, quite a few were, 88% were satisfied with their own life. If you compare that to what you found in homework number 5, you were asked to look at 5 different countries, I think, the United States, Canada, Germany, India, and Angola. And you see that as we move from some of the developed countries to developing countries, the fraction of people who are currently satisfied with their own lives decreases. I think that's not too surprising. We asked the question, how many of you are unable to afford food? So we had 7% who replied yes, 93% who replied no. And what you found in the Pew survey, again, not surprisingly, the fraction was much lower in higher income countries than it was in lower income developing countries. Then we asked, how many of you are optimistic that your life will improve? And I think for a college age population, it's not surprising that a large fraction were optimistic. Do you have a question? Okay. It's not surprising that a large fraction were optimistic that their lives will improve. Then we took a look at the Pew Global Attitudes Survey, and this was one of the results that I found most surprising, which is that when we compare in the developed countries, the fraction was actually comparable to, if not somewhat lower, than what we found in India and Angola. Any thoughts about why that might be the case? Go ahead. So the possibility of substantial economic growth, I think, is one very reasonable factor.
If you're unable to afford food, like a very little amount of inflow of money would greatly improve your life.
Mm-hmm. So small amounts of resources can lead to dramatic improvement. I think I owe you a t-shirt from last time. What size are you? Medium. Any other thoughts? Cultural beliefs and how hopeful a culture is. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Over there? I'm sorry, I missed the...
It would mean that there's different things. That
Right, if you don't have access to food, for example. So one issue would be access to media, another would be cynicism within the media and sort of the tone of news reports. Mm-hmm. Okay, size are you? Small. Okay. Can I ask you to do some t-shirt delivery? Okay, so how many of you were surprised by the results that you saw in the survey overall? Did you find it to be what you expected or surprising? Yeah, so I think it's a very interesting survey. It's repeated in a smaller number of countries every year, and I think they do the big survey every 3 to 5 years. So in lecture 5, we took a look at what is a health system? What are the functions of a health system? What are the goals of a health system? And then we looked at the 4 different types of health systems that different countries have established, including the entrepreneurial health system in the U.S., the welfare-oriented health system of Canada, and the comprehensive health system of the U.K. And we just briefly touched on socialist health systems, and we gave the example of Cuba and Vietnam as countries that have developed socialist health systems. So I passed out some envelopes, and the envelopes that I passed out should be one for every 3 or 4 people. The envelopes contain money. So who has an envelope? Okay, who, you in the back in the white shirt, what does your envelope say on the front? How much money is in your envelope?
$31.
Who has an envelope from a different city? And how much money is in your envelope?
$30.
Anybody else from somewhere different? Houston, how much money do you have? $5,600. Anybody else have a different place? Okay, how much do you have from Canada? $2,900. Okay, what do you think this money represents? Go ahead.
The amount spent on health per person?
It's per capita health expenditures in those countries. Okay? So, what we're going to ask you today is we're going to ask you to get in small groups, sitting around somebody who has an envelope full of money, and you are going to be the health ministry, and you're going to come up with a health system, and you're going to have to decide, what services will your health system pay for, and who will you pay for those services for? And I have a piece of paper I'm going to pass around that tells you what health services cost. Can you guys pass those out? So how much it costs per person to provide the following types of services. So on our list, we have dentistry, we have ophthalmology, we have prescription drugs, we have emergency medical care. Can you go to the ER? We have organ transplants. We have hospitalization. We have physician visits. Can you go to the doctor when you have the flu? We have nursing home care. Then we have ready access to high-tech procedures. Can I just go get an MRI whenever I need one? We have services to eliminate avoidable infant mortality, so things like vaccination, prenatal care, attended deliveries, and then we have preventive services for adults and children. All of those have a price tag associated with them per person, and so you can decide for $100 a person that you're going to provide access to ophthalmology for all of your citizens, or for $50 a person you can provide that to half of your population. So you've got a budget, you've got to decide which of these services that you're going to provide and for what fraction of your population you're going to provide that. And you have to keep in mind, if you don't provide that service, then if people need it, they have to find a way to pay for it on their own. So what I'd like you to do is just take 5 minutes and decide which of these services you are going to provide to what fraction of your population, and then we're going to ask a few of the groups to defend their choices. So let's take 5 minutes and do that.
spend a lot of money.
You can afford.
I mean, we can.
Yeah, so, okay, let's go ahead and get back together. So how about somebody from Tanzania? Can I get a group from Tanzania to report on what they selected? Okay, how much did you have? Okay.
The services, just as they are. So what we decided to do was to target specific parts of the population.
Okay.
So we decided to focus on eliminating avoidable infant mortality and also preventative services for adults and children. We looked at the other ones, but for like physician visits, we couldn't do that, and then we wouldn't be able to afford prescription drugs, so that wouldn't work. So we decided to focus on like vaccines and things that would prevent disease because we can't afford to treat them.
So that would cost $90 if you did the preventive for infants, children, and adults, but you only had $31. So how do you decide who gets the care?
It's hard. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. What about somebody from Houston? Do you have a group from Houston? Okay.
Go for it, Ingrid.
All the costs
add up to less than $4,000, and we had $5,274. So we just covered everything, and there's $1,334 left over.
So what did you do with your $1,334?
I don't know. Gave it to Tanzania.
Yeah, I think for some of the countries who have very, very limited resources, that international aid can be a big source of helping to fund your health system. And so, you know, go ask your neighbors for some of their leftover cash. How about Canada? Do we have a group from Canada? Okay. So Canada had 2,900, I think. Okay. All right, so what did you guys decide?
We covered everything except for physician visits and nursing home care.
Okay, physician visits, you skipped that. Why?
Covered everything else, mm-hmm. So we were hoping that since we're paying for everything else, the majority of the population might have the money to go to a physician on their own.
Okay. Okay. And how about Myanmar? Do we have a group from there?
So we had $30, and we wanted to cover preventative services for adults and children. That would be, so we'd have $20 maybe that they could pay out of pocket. Mm-hmm. For physician visits, we were hoping to petition to Doctors Without Borders. And then prescription drugs, we were hoping to get generic from maybe companies in the United States or something.
Okay. So the next thing that we want to do is we've thought now about the broad classes of service. Now we want to test your plans with some real people. So I think I need maybe 10 volunteers to come down front. Here's a t-shirt opportunity. Okay. You are Nick.
Okay.
Nick. You're Janet. You are Monica. You are Sheila. Let's see, you're Frank. You are Johnny Utah, my personal favorite.
Frank.
You're Margaret. Okay, you're Jake.
I'll go by Peggy.
Martin. Okay.
Do you have a person to be yet?
No.
You are Mary. Okay. So now I've forgotten who Janet is. We're starting with Janet. Are you Janet? Okay. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to have these different patients who are all in need of health care, and I'd like you to think about whether or not they would have been eligible for health care under your plan. And when you hear their story, if they weren't eligible for health care under your plan, does it make you want to change your plan? Okay, so we're going to start with Janet.
Here we go. Tell us who you are, Janet.
Janet is a 28-year-old divorced mother who is working, going to college with a small child. The child is turning 5 and has not had the vaccines needed to enter school, which includes hepatitis, diphtheria, pertussis, hemophilus influenza, tetanus, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, and pneumococcal. The total cost for all the required series is $22.
Okay, how many people covered Janet? And the child, yes. Okay. Anybody not covered Janet and her child? Okay, so we all picked preventive services, one of the most cost-effective health interventions that we have available. Actually, it generates cost savings in the long run. Okay, who do we have next? We have Nick. There we go.
Nick is a 40-year-old construction worker who has had hepatitis and is in serious need of a liver transplant. He is working part-time despite his illness and has been given a year to live without the transplant. He has never been unemployed and has 3 kids and a wife that depend on his support. His transplant will cost $4,384.13.
Who would have covered Nick? Okay, so only our higher income countries would have covered Nick. Anybody not cover Nick in a high income country? Anybody choose not to cover transplant? We saw in Oregon that not providing transplants was a big issue. In our lower income countries with fewer healthcare resources, obviously we can't afford that level of service. Okay, now I think we have Monica.
Monica. Monica is a 23-year-old who is in her first pregnancy. Her doctor suspects that she may be carrying twins and recommends that she have an ultrasound to confirm this, which will be important for decisions regarding her ability to carry to term. The ultrasound will cost $124.93.
Okay, so anybody not cover Monica? Who did not cover Monica? Okay, so our developing countries and anybody in a developed country, if you threw out physician visits, I don't think we cover Monica. Okay, who's next?
I'm Sheila, and Sheila is 35 and has been experiencing symptoms such as unexpected bleeding between menstrual cycles and pain during sexual intercourse. WebMD suggests she may need a pap smear. Her own mother died of cervical cancer at age 42. The cost for a pap smear is $25.42.
Okay, so this is preventive services for adults. Anybody not cover preventive services for adults? Actually, in most developing countries, we would not have pap smear screening, which is why cervical cancer is such a huge problem in developing countries. And in fact, it's quite interesting. In our own country, Medicare, which provides health care to senior citizens and people with disabilities, Medicare by statute does not provide any preventive services. So it used to not cover pap smears for elderly women. And it was only when groups of healthcare providers and health economists went and lobbied Congress to get a specific addition written to the legislation that Medicare began to cover pap smears. And they did it primarily because it is very, very cost effective.
Frank is 11 years old and is terminally ill with cystic fibrosis and needs a lung transplant. It has been shown that a double lung transplant provides an increase in life expectancy for the majority of children that undergo the procedure. With this risky procedure, Frank could add years to his life. It costs $3,596.64.
Okay, so I think all of you in the high-income countries covered transplants. The costs that we've given are just the cost for the initial surgical procedure, so that's why they may seem low compared to the $100,000 transplant costs that we talked about last time. So these are just the costs of that first surgical procedure to do the transplant. Who do we have next?
Johnny Utah. Are you Johnny?
Okay. Johnny Utah was out skydiving for his 30th birthday. Needless to say, his landing did not go as planned, and Johnny shattered his femur upon impact. He will need serious surgery to save his leg. The procedure is an open treatment of a femoral shaft fracture with implant and screws. This will cost $1,521.72.
Okay, who, any developed countries that did not cover Johnny? Johnny needs emergency services, and he might also be considered in the category where he needs rapid access to high-tech procedures. We'll see that that's one of the big differences between the U.S. and Canada. The health expenditures differ almost by a factor of two, not quite. And I think if you were in the U.S., you found that you could afford everything on this list. And in fact, the way that we came up with those costs on that list were by looking at the fraction of our health expenditures in the U.S. that goes to each of those different areas. No, we have not accounted for purchasing power parity in these costs. So the way that we generated these costs, there were two things that we did. For the infant services to avoid the unavoidable infant death, we actually looked at estimates of what that would cost in developing countries, and it's been estimated that it would cost $30 to $40 per person per year to eliminate all unavoidable infant mortality in countries where those services are not available. So that really is a real number in dollars that you had in your envelope. Everything else was estimated based on what it would cost in the United States. So what we did is we looked at what fraction of our health expenditures are devoted to physician services or are devoted to dentistry or ophthalmology. So that's where the numbers come from. So it would cost less to provide those services in a country where labor was not as expensive, for example.
Where does the prescription meds fall in terms of like anti-reduction meds, transplants, and other meds that are prescribed in we lump that together under the prescription drug category. Mm-hmm. Okay, who do we have next? Margaret.
Margaret is an 82-year-old woman who's diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease several months ago. Her condition has progressed to such a point that 24-hour care has become necessary and her family can no longer give her the kind of care she needs. The cost of nursing home care for Margaret is $150 a day.
That is the average cost in the U.S. for nursing home care per day. Who chose not to provide nursing home care? Okay, quite a number of countries. That's a big problem for how to fund nursing home care. It's very expensive. Who do we have next?
Jake is a 7-year-old boy from an underprivileged family. Due to his family's inability to pay for regular dental care, Jake has developed an abscessed tooth. Left untreated, the abscess may compromise the immune system and in some cases may become life-threatening. The only treatment for Jake is the excision of the tooth. This will cost $143.55.
Okay, anybody not providing dental services? Okay. In fact, not available in developing countries due to a lack of resources. We heard Dr. Parkerson talk about how great the need was in Santa Ana, Honduras. Also interesting, in Canada, the comprehensive health system in Canada does not provide any dental services or ophthalmology services. Who do we have next?
Martin is an overweight 68-year-old man with hypertension. Without proper medication, Martin's condition puts him at an increased risk for myocardial infarction and may lead to heart failure. The cost of high blood pressure medicine is $207 a month. Martin is on a fixed income and cannot afford this additional expense.
Okay, so if you didn't provide prescription drug services, you didn't help out Martin. When we do our unit on cardiovascular disease, we're going to come back to Martin's case. I think it's a great example where societies have to choose, do they want to invest up front in prevention or do they want to pay in the end for very expensive interventional therapies to treat a heart attack or heart failure? So we'll see that it's very, very expensive to provide those invasive therapies for end-stage heart disease, relatively less expensive to invest in preventive services. Now, up until this year, Medicare did not provide prescription drug services, and I'm sure you've all heard about much of the controversy associated with some of the new Medicare prescription drug plans and all the problems that states are having trying to implement Medicare Plan D. Where are we next?
Mary Muteba. Mary is a 9-month-old infant and has been stricken with a violent bout of diarrhea. She has become increasingly ill from dehydration and the inability to absorb essential nutrients. The excessive diarrhea has also caused a painful rash to develop that has left Mary in constant pain. Left untreated, her diarrhea could prove to be fatal. The cost for a physician office visit to treat her diarrhea is $75.50.
Okay, so Mary again falls into the physician visit. And so if Mary's family doesn't have a way to pay for that, they might delay care until a point where it's much more difficult, until she might have a very severe dehydration and might require hospitalization. Okay, thank you very much. If you want to grab a t-shirt, the pile is right there. Hopefully we have the size you want. So I think these are all very real examples of the kinds of trade-offs that health systems have to deal with. I mean, we saw last time when we talked about the Oregon Health Plan and their attempt to reform Medicaid in Oregon, the very real situation that developed when they did not continue to provide coverage for organ transplants. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take a look at how healthcare costs have changed. I'll get to your question in just one second. How healthcare costs have changed over time. We're going to look at
what causes healthcare costs to increase so much in the United States. And then we're going to go back to Oregon, and we're going to take a look at how they tried to cope with the fallout over the Coby Howard case. So they are realistic numbers. I mean, we looked up these costs. These are what Medicare will reimburse for these procedures. We somewhat underestimated the transplant services because we didn't include, you know, the long-term medication and all of the other procedural costs that would be associated with those. I think what you'll see today in the U.S. is that a lot of our expenditures go actually toward administrative costs, where when you compare that to Canada for a single payer, which is the government, they have much lower administrative costs than we have here, where we have multiple payers. And so that's one thing that consumes a number of our resources. Another thing that consumes a lot of our resources is that we invest much more in high-tech medical procedures, like the number of MRIs per person, for example, is much higher in the United States than it is in Canada, and that drives costs. But I think the bottom line is that just as a society, these are the decisions that we have made that we haven't been able as a society to move away from an entrepreneurial health system. We're not going to cover the attempt to reform the U.S. health system that the Clinton administration tried to implement. They tried to move more toward a welfare-oriented health system, and there was a lot of backlash associated with that. We aren't, unfortunately, going to have time to go into all the details of it. We'll just look at what the state of Oregon did. Any other questions? Okay. So what I want to do today is look at how healthcare costs have changed over time. As you'll see, they've gone up. What drives these increases in cost? And we're going to go back to Oregon. So let's look in the United States at how healthcare costs have changed over time. It's a very interesting graph. It has a dual y-axis. On this axis, we've got health expenditures. This includes both public and private health expenditures in dollars. Here, we're looking at health expenditures as a fraction of the GDP. So the bars represent the health expenditures in dollars. The dots and the lines here represent health expenditures as a fraction of the gross domestic product. It's a little bit misleading because the time axis changes. Here's 1960, 1970, 1980, 85, 90, 95, and now we go to every year. But you can see that consistently over time, health expenditures have gone up, both in absolute dollars, and they've gone up as a fraction of the gross domestic product. And they're projected by 2010 that the health expenditures in the United States will consume 17% of the gross domestic products. That's 1/6 of the economy. And some people say, you know, maybe we like to spend that much in the United States. What's the problem with our health expenditures being a much relatively larger fraction of the gross domestic product? And I think one thing that you have to recognize is that it represents an opportunity cost. If we spend that money on healthcare, we're not spending it on something else like education or defense. So you know, whatever we spend here, it's not available to be spent on other things. And that's the choice that we've made. I'm not saying it's a wrong choice. It's just that it allows us not to make other choices to use those resources. Consistently, both in terms of absolute dollars and in terms of the fraction of our GDP that we devote to healthcare costs, we spend more in the United States than other countries spend. However, other countries have also been trying to cope with rising healthcare costs. And the rate at which they've been rising is a bit higher in the United States, but not dramatically higher than it is in other countries. If we look at the fraction of the world's GDP that's devoted to health expenditures, between 1950 and 1997, It more than doubled. It went from just over 3% to almost 8%. And so both in terms of absolute dollars and in terms of a fraction of the GDP, health expenditures have been rising throughout the world. We started out higher in the United States, and we've continued to stay higher. Here we're looking at dollars spent per person in the United States going from 1986 and projecting out to 2010. We're at about $5,700 right now per person. We're projected to go almost to $10,000 out in 2012. Question? These are annual per capita expenditures, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a very interesting graph. This is the number of people in the United States who work in healthcare. And this is the percentage of people who work in the private sector who are employed in healthcare. And it's projected that at this time, that 10% of jobs in the private sector are healthcare related. And it's not surprising then, if you look at the fraction of our GDP, it's a healthcare, very similar numbers. So when we look at how healthcare costs have changed in the United States over time, they've gone up, both in terms of the absolute dollars that we spend and the fraction of our economy that goes to pay for healthcare, and in terms of the number of people who work in the healthcare sector. So why have these costs gone up so much? There's much debate about this, but I think people generally agree that three factors have contributed to increasing healthcare costs, both in the United States and throughout the world. One is the aging of the population. One is increasing use of high-tech procedures, and another factor is increasing prescription drug costs. Prescription drug costs are actually the fastest growing category of health spending today. When we look at health technologies, what we'll find throughout Unit 3 is that health technologies that were designed with the idea that they might actually save money, what we find is that if we get a cheaper, less invasive procedure, we use it on more patients. And so when we look at balloon angioplasty, for example, so we're going to look at treatment of coronary artery disease. It used to be that we had two choices to treat coronary artery disease. We could medically manage the disease. There's a point at which that no longer works. The disease has progressed to a point where those drugs are no longer effective. It used to be that the only alternative was open heart surgery to do a bypass graft. That's a very invasive procedure. Now we have available to us balloon angioplasty. And the idea was that balloon angioplasty is a much less expensive procedure. It's a much less invasive procedure. So the idea was that if you could replace open heart surgery with balloon angioplasty, you could save money. What we find happening instead, though, is that because it's less invasive, patients are a lot more willing to consider having this procedure. Physicians are a lot more willing to consider offering this procedure to their patients. As a result, more patients are getting good health care, but we didn't save money because we're doing more and more procedures. And in fact, what happens is we find that not only do we expand the indications for use, but we find that procedures are additive. What that means is that instead of just having open heart surgery, instead what happens is I might have balloon angioplasty. If that fails, I might have another balloon angioplasty. If that fails, then I might have open heart surgery. And so as a result, my health is better. But as a result, we've ended up spending more money because I've had two balloon angioplasties plus I've had open heart surgery. And so it's a real difficult issue as to how can we use technology to reduce healthcare costs when, as cheaper, better procedures get developed, more people want access to them? This slide looks at the aging of the population. And this is data from the United States. starting in 1970, showing every decade the expected Medicare enrollment. So in 1970, there were 20 people enrolled in Medicare. It's projected that that number will triple by 2030. If we look at that as a percentage of our population, again, here we're looking at the percentage of the population in the U.S. enrolled in Medicare, which provides health insurance to elderly and disabled citizens. In 1970, just under 10%, be over 20% by 2030. It's particularly a problem because health care is more expensive for elderly people. We spend a lot more per person for elderly people. Their healthcare needs are greater. And so as our population ages, it's going to further drive increases in healthcare costs. So we talked about the aging population, the use of technology, and increasing prescription drug costs as three factors that are particularly important in increases in the United States. This is a very interesting graph. There's a lot of information on this graph, but I think it speaks to why are our healthcare expenditures so much higher in the United States compared to other developed countries with similar income levels. And so what's shown on this graph is here's the United States down in the bottom. Here's the United Kingdom with a comprehensive health system. Here's Denmark and Sweden. And there are several factors that are shown here. Here is health expenditures as a percentage of the GDP. Here's health expenditures just in dollars adjusted for purchasing power parity. Here's how much is spent on prescription drugs. This is a number of MRI scanners, number of CT scanners per person, number of hospital beds per person, number of doctors per person, and fraction of people who work in the healthcare sector. The scale goes from 0 to 1. So what they did is they picked the country that had the highest either rate of spending or number of MR scanners, and they normalized all the other countries by that. So you can see in the United States, we have the highest health expenditure as a fraction of our GDP. We have the highest absolute health expenditure. We have the largest number of MRI scanners, and we have the largest number of CT scanners. If we look at Sweden, they have the largest number of people working in health employment, they have the largest number of doctors per person, and the largest number of hospital beds per person. But if you compare health outcomes in the United States to health outcomes in the United Kingdom, actually they rank better than we do in terms of many health outcomes, and they manage to do it while they spend a lot less money, employ many fewer people, have fewer physicians, hospital beds, and particularly fewer MR scanners and CT scanners. And similarly in Denmark as well. So I think you can really see some of the factors that drive our health expenditures. Okay. One of the things that happened in the United States as an attempt to try and slow this dramatic increase in health expenditures was the development of managed care health insurance plans. So in a health maintenance organization, ideally what was supposed to happen was that you would have a primary care physician. And your primary care physician would control all of your access to specialized care. So if you were going to be admitted to the hospital, or if you were going to see a specialist, you had to first see your primary care physician, and they had to authorize then your admission to the hospital or your visit to go and see a specialist. And in fact, the advent of managed care did help to slow some of the growth in healthcare spending. In particular, it slowed the adoption of some high-tech procedures, and it did also reduce hospital cost growth by limiting hospital stays, for example. But as those limitations began to impact patients more and more, there was somewhat of a public backlash. Some of you may remember the furor about something called drive-through delivery. The drive-through delivery was when A woman went to the hospital for labor and delivery. Many HMOs would only authorize her to be in the hospital for 24 hours, and then she would be discharged. And that represented actually quite a decrease compared to the standard length of time that people had been used to under previous insurance plans. And people felt like this was placing moms and babies at risk. And in fact, Congress later mandated that all insurance companies had to provide 48 hours of hospital stay as a result of some of the consumer backlash. And so what happened in response to this consumer backlash was types of health insurance where care was less tightly managed. So things like preferred provider organizations and point of service plans, where your primary physician wasn't always the gateway to specialist care or hospital care, but if you made the choice to go around that gateway, then you had to pay for more of the cost of care out of your own pocket. And we talked about administrative costs in the United States. We actually spend between 1/4 and 1/3 of all of our health expenditures on paperwork. Okay? 27% of healthcare workers do mostly paperwork, and that's between double and triple what is spent in Canada because it is a more streamlined administrative system because there's a single payer. We also talked about the use of additive technology. So the growth in computed tomography, for example, where hospitals would replace an X-ray machine that previously might cost $175,000 with a $1 million CT scanner. And then increased utilization of technology. There was a fourfold increase in balloon angioplasty over an 8-year period. And you began to see companies doing direct marketing of healthcare procedures. Okay, next time you look at, say, Time magazine, you'll see ads for balloon angioplasty, for LASIK. So they're doing direct marketing of high-tech procedures. Same is true with prescription drugs. Okay, skip this. We talked about the aging population and how the elderly really account for a large fraction of healthcare spending, 40% of hospital stays, 1/4 of prescription drug use, and more than half of all health expenditures are devoted to people over the age of 65. Okay, we talked about that. So I want to go back now to Oregon. We asked you at the beginning of class to be the health system and to make some of these trade-offs between what care is covered and who has access to that care. So what I want to do is I want to go back to the state of Oregon and I want to take a look at what they did to try and solve the same problem that you looked at. So we talked about Kobe Howard's death, and it resulted in very widespread media coverage about the problem with the Oregon health plan. At that time, Oregon had a state senator whose name was John Kitzhaber. He was a former emergency room physician. He later became governor of the state of Oregon, and he really was sort of the visionary force that pushed behind the reform in the Oregon health plan. And what Kitzhaber said is that the state simply cannot afford to pay for every procedure for every person who needs it. We don't have enough money to do that. However, he said, if we're willing to ration care, then we can expand the number of people who have access to health care. And so he tried to go about making these decisions about what services were offered in a very public way with a lot of public input. In 1989, when these discussions began, at that time, only 42% of low-income Americans were covered under Medicaid. And we talked last time about how the fraction of people covered by Medicaid varies tremendously from state to state. Less than half of people who needed it were covered by it. Oregon, in 1989, did two things. It first passed a bill that mandated that private employers had to provide health insurance for all of their employees. Reforms like this are sometimes called play or pay reforms, and what they require is that employers either have to offer health insurance to all their employees, or they have to pay into a special fund that will go into expanding access to health care in that state for low-income residents. Now, Oregon, in order to enforce this, they had to get a waiver from the federal government. They were never able to do that. So one of the ways that they tried to expand health care by mandating employers to provide health insurance ultimately failed because they couldn't get the federal approval to implement this part of the plan. However, what they wanted to do with their state funds was they wanted to be able to provide Medicaid insurance, this is the state-funded insurance, to everybody in the state who was below the federal poverty line. The way they were going to do that was by rationing care. So they had to decide how to ration that care. The first attempt to do that did not work very well. The first attempt to do that was they calculated for all different types of health services a priority rating. And the priority rating that they calculated was how much does the treatment cost? They divided that by the expected benefit, which they then multiplied by how long, how many years the benefit would last. So it's a ratio of cost to benefit. So they just went in, they did that for all these health services. The way that they got at the net expected benefit and the duration of the benefit was they surveyed a bunch of physicians and they asked them to estimate these factors. Okay? Here are the rankings that came out of that. And you can see, if you were to draw a line, say here, it wouldn't really make any sense, right? So capping of a tooth, which costs $38 and gives you some minor benefit that lasts a short period of time, actually got ranked ahead of emergency surgery to treat a woman who has an ectopic pregnancy. An ectopic pregnancy is a life-threatening condition. It's expensive to treat, but look at the benefit that it adds. It saves your life, provides an average of 48 years of additional life. But just because of the way that they calculated these, the cost-to-benefit ratios, tooth capping got ranked ahead of ectopic pregnancy. Similarly, splints to treat temporomandibular joint, causes joint pain in the jaw, got ranked ahead of emergency surgery to treat an appendectomy. So life-saving procedures were getting ranked below some kind of minor procedures that are very cheap but offer minor benefit. And so they said, okay, this is not going to work. Instead, So what they did was they surveyed physicians, and they surveyed hundreds of physicians to say, you know, on a scale of 0 to 100, what is the benefit of this treatment expected to be? So it was subjective, it was qualitative, but there was a surprising degree of agreement that they found when they did that survey. You know, things that were clearly life-saving, people agreed on. Things that clearly had a minor benefit, people tended to agree on. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but what they found was they got this ranking that they couldn't draw a line and have it make sense. So instead, what they did is they said, clearly one of our highest priority treatments to offer is an acute condition that is life-threatening, where if I treat it, I'm going to gain a lot of treating it. And so they had 17 different categories of services. And the most important category of services where someone is going to die unless we provide this procedure for them, and then they will have a long and healthy life afterward. And they went on down the list. Things toward the bottom of the list were chronic conditions that are not life-threatening, where we're going to get a short-term benefit with a small improvement in the quality of life. Okay? And then within those categories, they ranked services according to the cost-to-benefit ratio. And so what the legislature in Oregon decided to do was to go forward with that ranking and then draw a line. So they would look at the amount of money that they had, they would look at the number of people that they had to cover service for, and they would draw a line. Everything above the line would be covered, everything below the line would not be covered. And here's the actual list that they developed. This is from 1999, and here is the line that was drawn. Okay. And you can see that the services that are just above the line are sort of minor services as well. And the services that are just below the line, here we have complex prosthetics. The services that are just below the line, again, we have nothing where it is a life-saving procedure that's going to result in dramatic addition in life expectancy. So, did it work? There was a lot of controversy over this plan, primarily because there was such a public discussion of rationing healthcare. And such a public discussion had really never been carried out before in the United States. Plenty of states had cut people from their Medicaid rolls, so they just said, you have no care. No state had ever said, I want to cover everyone, but I'm not going to cover all services for everyone. And people were uncomfortable with that idea. So if we look at whether this worked, in fact what happened was there really was no widespread rationing of care for a number of reasons. The first of which is that actually the number of services that they excluded was relatively small, and their medical value was somewhat marginal. In fact, the benefit package that was offered now under the new Oregon Health Plan was more generous than the previous Medicare plan. So transplants, which Kobe Howard was denied, are now covered under the Oregon Health Plan. The other reason that I think it worked in practice is that the line is a bit fuzzy. The treatment for things below the line is not paid for, but the diagnosis of them is paid for. And so physicians would try and make a loophole. They would claim to be diagnosing the condition so they could get reimbursed for it, but at the same time they could offer treatment for some of those conditions. The plan ended up not saving a tremendous amount of money. It saved about 2% of the cost compared to what they would have spent under the old health plan. So how did they expand coverage? They were very successful in terms of expanding coverage. 600,000 people who were previously had no insurance got insurance under the new health plan. And in the state, they saw their rate of uninsured citizens drop from 17% to 11%, and I think this is really a spectacular achievement. Number of uninsured children dropped from 21% to 8%. They saw a reduction in the number of people who were going to the emergency room to get primary care, because now they had access to be able to go to their doctor's office before it became an emergency. They saw a reduction in the number of babies born with low birth weight because women had access to prenatal care. But they didn't pay for it by the savings that they generated from rationing. They increased the cigarette tax as one of the ways to pay for this plan. And they also moved more of their Medicaid recipients into managed care plans so that they tried to save money by managing their access to care. And I think one of the messages to take away from what happened in Oregon is that when you have such a public discussion about rationing, you talk so explicitly not just about who has access to care, but who has access to what care, the result is that it becomes very, very difficult to ration those services. There was just an enormous amount of backlash initially against this plan. Now, what's happening in Oregon today? The state economy, like many state economies, has weakened in Oregon. And so as a result, what Oregon has had to do is to think about implementing sort of a sliding scale access to the Oregon Health Plan. And what they would do is they would now rank their population in order of how much they need access to the Oregon Health Plan. And so the first group of people would be poor pregnant women and children under 6 in families who are less than twice the federal poverty line. They were deemed to be those most in need of access to health insurance. The second group would be adults at 50% of the federal poverty line, and then a sliding scale moving up, and then medically needy people, defined to be those people who have very high medical expenses, HIV/AIDS patients, for example, who have a limited income but are not below the federal poverty line. And the plan in Oregon today is to, as resources become less and less available, begin cutting these people from access to the Oregon Health Plan. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that today. I'll look it up and we'll put a question on the test about it. So, question in the back? It does vary dramatically by state. This gives you what Oregon is doing. Now, I don't know the number in Texas. Yes, this is specific. So the Oregon Health Plan is pretty much synonymous with Medicaid in Oregon, and it's very state-dependent. I want to play a quick NPR clip for you about the public reaction to these changes in the Oregon Health Plan. This, I believe, is from last year. Oh, it's a bit older than that.
Federal Medicaid program, and the state continues to add people to Medicaid's coverage list, even as other states talk about cutting back. The latest expansion plan could mean some people will see their benefits cut, and NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Portland. The Oregon Health Plan is unique. In 1994, the state set up an explicit rationing system. It took the health care services normally covered by Medicaid and ranked them in order of importance. State would use its Medicaid dollars to pay for things near the top of the list, but not those near the bottom. The money saved would be used to provide health care for more low-income and disabled residents. The federal government, which had to approve the plan, went along. Today, Oregon, along with Minnesota, Tennessee, Vermont, and Hawaii, has one of the most generous Medicaid programs in the country. Many of those served come here to the sprawling Oregon Health Sciences University, state's largest medical complex. As she takes a break after visiting a sick relative, 67-year-old Nancy Sawyer says the Oregon Health Plan is a good thing.
You see people next door, they're starving, you got to cover for the grocery, you're going to sit there and watch them starve? I don't think so. It's not for any kind of people at all.
The fourth-generation Oregonian expresses the views of many here. Taking care of the less fortunate is part of the ethos of Oregon. That social ethic is embraced by the state's popular Democratic governor, John Kitzhaber, who happens to be a physician. He fathered the Oregon Health Plan and has pushed to expand it. Now, at a time when the state has the highest unemployment in the country, he's trying to add even more people to the rolls. But state revenues have fallen substantially, and in order to keep Medicaid costs the same, the governor proposed cutting the benefits of some in order to allow more people to get on the Oregon Health Plan. Mark Gibson is one of the governor's health policy advisors.
It's better for us to expand the coverage, even if it's to a less comprehensive package of benefits, than it is to keep people entirely out of the system and not give them any coverage at all.
More than 400,000 people of the state's 3.5 million residents are currently covered by the Oregon Health Plan. The governor wants to add about 58,000 more, many of them the working poor. Getting on the plan would be a big boost for Jessica Clark, a single mother who's working full-time and going to school.
I'd like to be able to see people who are trying to get ahead, such as myself, be able to do that and be able to take care of their children at the same time. You can't get ahead when you're having to come up with, you know, hundreds of dollars a month to pay for insurance.
But while Clark is a potential winner, a cancer patient named John, who works part-time, is a potential loser. Elizabeth Byers of Project Equity, an advocacy group for those on the Oregon Health Plan, tells his story.
He makes a little less than $8,000 a year, saves about $300 for the Oregon Health Plan. If this new program should come into effect, John
goes on to talk
when
about
how when it comes to integrated healthcare, Oregon often leads the way. They would allow fewer new people into the plan.
We would rather see growth be a little bit more careful and then make sure that we do maintain our budget neutrality. What we thought was the best way of doing it was to expand the areas of the public-private partnership.
They would, for example, increase government subsidies to consumers so they could buy private insurance. If the two sides could finally agree on the plan, something that is by no means certain, the Bush administration is likely to approve it. But even if all that is resolved, one huge hurdle remains: access to care. Bruce Goldberg is medical director of Care Oregon, the state's largest provider of services under the state plan.
The capacity of the healthcare system to see people is limited and getting worse.
Nowhere is that more obvious than at the university's perpetually crowded family medicine clinic. As Medicaid reimbursement rates to physicians have fallen, many doctors no longer provide care to Oregon Health Plan patients. So the number of people coming here is growing, according to clinic manager Christy Ward.
We have patients on a daily basis who are calling to try to get established in our clinic, and we're having to say, you know, we're not able to accommodate you at this time. That's something that's new for this clinic. There has never been a time in the history of this clinic that we've ever had to say, gosh, have we matched our capacity?
Problems of access and rising healthcare costs are by no means unique to Oregon, but this state is once again trying to find innovative ways to get healthcare to the poor. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Portland.
So that's one of the things that we didn't talk about in our exercise, is if you've got a limited healthcare budget, one of the things that you can do is you can cut fees that are paid to providers as a way to expand care. And the U.S. has actually substantially cut fees that are provided both through Medicare and Medicaid. And because sometimes the reimbursement actually is lower than the cost to provide the care, physicians will not accept those patients as patients. It's also a problem in many developing countries where pay for healthcare workers is very, very low, and then they get recruited to come to other countries to fill the needs of their healthcare labor force. Okay, so the last thing that I want to talk about is just two quick things. We do have our exam on Thursday. Take a look at the practice exam. Also, I have posted the new project description, and you should begin to think about who will be your team members on the project and what disease you're interested in taking a look at. You'll have two assignments on the project. One is to write an editorial about a proposed change in health policy, and the other is to actually design a mock-up of a new health technology that you'll present during the last days of class. Okay, thank you.